When you were a kid, did you ever stick something up your nose and get it stuck there? You know, Cheerios, a crayon, Play-Doh, Lego blocks. I don't speak from personal experience. Frankly, personally, I don't understand the psychology that says, I wonder if this will fit up my nose. But apparently it happens a lot, especially with kids. Now, confession is good for the soul. So who would confess this morning? Who has stuck something up your nose and got it stuck there? What was it?
It was a man-sized Kleenex, and I was 2, and I ended up having to have surgery.
It was a what-size Kleenex? A man-sized Kleenex. She stuffed it up her nose, had to have surgery to get it out, and to this day, she feels the effects of it. Wow. Anybody can top that? Anybody else that stuck something up your nose and got it stuck there?
A rock.
Pastor David stuck a rock. Let tell everybody, Pastor
it's
David.
It's still there.
Yeah, it's still there. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine... Imagine that moment when you first realize, oh no, it's stuck. And I'm not going to be able to get it out. And I'm going to have to tell mom, and brothers and sisters are going to know, and then friends are going to know, and everybody's going to make fun of me. Getting stuck is no fun. You may remember several months ago, I told you how one day, on a Friday, I was here all alone in the church, and I went into the one-seater tiny restroom at the far west end of the building, and after I'd washed my hands and turned to go out, I grabbed the doorknob and twisted it, and the doorknob twisted it, but the mechanism inside would not respond. I was locked in this tiny little... Immediately, I realized the troubles. I was the only person in the building. I didn't have my phone in my pocket with me when I went in to the restroom. It was about noontime. David wasn't expecting me home until late that night. So suddenly, in a panic, I realized I could be stuck in this claustrophobic little restroom for 8 hours before anybody would know that I was missing. So I grabbed the knob, gave it another twist, and with all my might, I pulled. And thankfully, the door broke open. Because it's no fun getting stuck. That's what we're going to talk about today, getting stuck. Not so much getting physically stuck, which is bad enough, but something far worse. Those times when we get stuck in life. The man in today's gospel story was stuck until he encountered Jesus, and Jesus showed him the way out. Let's see what we can learn from today's amazing encounter with Jesus, starting with a prayer. God, your word is full of amazing lessons for how to walk this path of life. Today, we bring you a very common challenge, getting stuck. As followers of Jesus, as people of faith, how should we respond when we feel stuck in life? Jesus, teach us something amazing today. We ask in your holy name. Amen. So John chapter 5, verses 2 and 3, in Jerusalem by the Sheep's Gate, there is a pool called in Hebrew Bethzatha, which has 5 porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. After the original text of John's gospel began circulating, at some point scribes added an additional explanation so that we could understand why so many invalids gathered at this pool. That additional explanation is recorded in some Bibles as verse 4, which says, "For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool at Beth Zapha and stirred up the water. Whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well from whatever disease that person had." We don't know if actual miracles were happening at this pool or just rumors of miracles, but at least we now understand why so many invalids were flocking to this pool and waiting for the water to be stirred. Imagine what it must have been like when the water stirred and so many desperate people competed to be the first to reach the water. Verse 5, one man was there who had been ill for 38 years. 38 years of pain and struggle and frustration. Verse 6, when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there a long time, Jesus said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" What? Duh! Jesus! What kind of a question is that? This man has been sick for 38 long years. He's so weak, he can barely move without the assistance of others. He's been at this pool for months on end, waiting, hoping to be healed. And Jesus asks him this silly question, "Do you want to be made well?" Jesus, I thought you were smart. I thought you had insight. I thought you saw into the hearts of people. Yes, he does. Amen. And that's precisely why he asks the question, "Do you want to be made well?" Implicit in Jesus' question is the recognition that we have, when we find ourselves stuck, we have an amazing way of adapting to our circumstances and can often get comfortable with the familiarity of the status quo. We may pretend to want change. We may even genuinely believe we want change. All the while, subconsciously, there may be something inside of us that fears that change more than the pain of the status quo. Are you with me? When my dad was midway through his working career, he got fired from his dream job through no fault of his own. He was a whistleblower. He reported something that illegal that was taking place, and he got fired for it. In the aftermath, he was devastated. His dream job was lost, and for months on end, he would not look for a new job. He sat, he moped. Because you see, if he went out and got a new job, he'd have to let go of his anger. If he went out and got a new job, he'd have to admit that his dream job was gone and it was never coming back again. If he went out and got a new job, he'd have to reinvent himself in a whole new career. And by the way, to his credit, he eventually did so very successfully. But his experience is something that we can all relate to. When we get stuck, there is just a certain familiarity, a certain comfort about that place we find ourselves in. So much we have to let go if we move on from that space, if we embrace change in our life. Mark Twain once said, "The only person who likes change is a wet baby." Therapist Virginia Sater says, "People often prefer the certainty of misery to the misery of uncertainty." True story, a Christian counselor was working with a client whose anger was wreaking havoc in his life, in his workplace, and in his family. So he finally decided to reach out and try to get some help. As their conversation was unfolding, there came a point where the therapist says to him, "Tell me what your life would look like if you got rid of your anger." She says he paused for a second and then said to her, "If I got rid of my anger, what would I have left?" It's an amazing insight, right? You're probably maybe familiar with the old Fleetwood Mac hit song Landslide that was eventually re-recorded by Dixie Chicks and became a hit of their own as well. It tells the story of a woman who's in a dead-end relationship and struggling with what to do about it. A couple of the lines she speaks are so poignant when she says, "I've been afraid of changing because I've built my life around you." We all do that. We build our life around the situations that we find ourselves in. We have to. We adapt. We accommodate. We survive. What choice do we have? And even in the pain of those situations when it's bad, we can still find a certain comfort because at least our situation is familiar. At least we know what to expect. At least we know how to survive in that situation. But if I go making bold change in my life, who knows what might happen? The cure might be worse than the disease itself. Plus, change is hard work. A husband and a wife were having a conversation. He says, "Change don't come easily." She says, "Doesn't." "Doesn't what?" he says. She says, "Come easily. Change doesn't come easily." He says, "So you're agreeing with me?" She says, "Yes, but..." He says, "Then why didn't you just say I agree?" She says, "But I..." He says, "We're always arguing." She says, "I'm not arguing." He says, "Yes, you are." She says, "No, I'm not." He says, "Then what is it that we're doing?" She says, "Honestly, I have no idea." He says, "Well, whatever it is, I'm sick of it and it needs to change." She says, to quote a wise man, "Change don't come easily." He says, "Exactly." A while back, there was an article in Fast Company magazine, a tech magazine, talking about our powerful human resistance to change. The introductory paragraph begins like this: "Change or die." What if you were given that choice? What if a well-informed, trusted authority figure said you had to make difficult and enduring changes in the way you think and act, and that if you didn't, your time on earth would soon end, a lot sooner than it had to? Could you change when change really mattered? Then the article goes on to describe an epic study led by Dr. Edward Miller, former dean of Johns Hopkins University Medical School. A team of his researchers studied over 600,000 heart bypass patients. Each of these patients, after their surgery, had had a conversation where their doctor looked them in the eye and said, "You have to make significant changes in your lifestyle to reduce the risk that you're going to die prematurely. You have to eat healthier, exercise more, reduce stress, reduce your drinking, stop smoking, etc., etc." 2 years after their bypass surgeries, the researchers went back to each of these 600,000 plus people and interviewed them to try to ascertain whether they had made any lasting changes in their lifestyle. What percentage of those 600,000 plus, would you guess, had by 2 years later managed to sustain some lasting changes in their lifestyle?
10.
I hear a lot of ranges and guesses. The actual number, 10%. I mean, think about that. Your doctor says you have two choices: serious risk of premature death or significant lifestyle changes. And the odds are 9 to 1 that we will choose the risk of premature death rather than dealing with the pain and the difficulty of making lasting change in our life. That is how resistant we humans are to change. And that is the first point in our gospel story. Jesus says to this man, "Do you really want to be made well?" Jesus recognizes that it's possible that this man may have become so familiar with the patterns of living with chronic illness that perhaps he had settled for the comfort of that familiarity and would be so wedded to that intricate network of attitudes, patterns, and ideas and flow of life that he would rather, subconsciously, rather stay in that place of pain than deal with the hard work, the uncertainty, and the scary nature of change. Where in your life today do you feel stuck? According to Jesus, the first question we need to ask ourselves is, do I really want to be made well? Am I truly prepared to let go of the comfort of my familiar status quo bad situation to embrace the discomfort and the uncertainty of change in my life? If the answer to that question is yes, then we're ready for what comes next in our gospel passage. Going back to verse 6 and then on to verse 7. Jesus said to the sick man, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm making my way, someone always steps down ahead of me." What I hear in this man's answer is, when Jesus says, "Do you really want to be made well?" What I hear in his answer is, "Yes, but." Yes, I want to be made well, but there's nobody to help me. That brings us to the second great insight in our gospel story. The second great obstacle to creating change in our life: we have a tendency to outsource our power. We want someone, maybe it's God, or someone else, or some group of people, to do for us what we don't want to do for ourselves. Yes, I want to change, provided you will do the hard work for me. It's another very powerful, often subconscious, human tendency. Years ago, when our church first acquired this building, back in 2002, first time our church had acquired property. So we raised up a volunteer team called the Temple Keepers, a team of volunteers who clean the building. By the way, to this day, we still have that team. Thank you to those of you who volunteer on that team. It saves the church thousands of dollars every year. So we raised up this Temple Keepers team way back in 2002, and the leader of the team at the time was just an excellent leader. I mean, she would remind her people. She did the schedule. She would follow up with them to make sure there was accountability and things got done. The team ran like a top until something changed. She and her spouse decided they wanted to have a child, and she became pregnant. Things still ran well until 7 or 8 months into her pregnancy, when people started missing and the accountability wasn't as great. And so sometimes on a Friday at the end of the week before Sunday, I'd go in the restrooms and, oh, they haven't been cleaned. And, well, the buck stops here, so I'd clean the restrooms. This pattern continued for a while. I remember one Friday in particular. It was an exhausting week, and I went into the restroom, and, oh, the restrooms haven't been cleaned. And so I've got to clean them, and I'm feeling sorry for myself. Why me, Jesus, the things I do for you, you know, blah, blah, blah. And as I'm cleaning the toilets, I come to a stall that's out of toilet paper, which means I have to open the toilet paper dispenser and put in some toilet paper. And I'd never opened a commercial toilet paper dispenser before. You know, they have these little key things on them. I knew where the key was. It was on a ring that was on the handle of the mop bucket, so that none of our volunteers would inadvertently put it in their pocket and walk away. And so I bent over at the mop bucket to try to get the key off the ring. And I'm not very mechanical, so I could not figure out for the life of me how to get this key off the key ring. But I had to get this dispenser opened, so I came up with a really clever idea. I figured out that if I pick up the mop bucket high enough and balance it on my knee, I can get the key while it's still on the ring into the thing and twist it. And so as I'm trying to do this, the bucket tips a little bit. Icky water splashes out, and then it tumbles to the ground. I stand up, erupting with frustration. I'm normally pretty laid back. Erupting with frustration. I literally, probably the only time in my life, I pounded my fist against the stall wall and said, God, you've got to fix this team. At which point I sensed, it's like a light bulb came on in my dull brain, and I sensed God saying to me, why are you asking me to fix what you already have the power to fix yourself? Recruit a new volunteer leader and give the poor woman a decent maternity leave. So that's what I did. And everything was fine again. Truth is, we do that all the time in various ways, often without even realizing it. We want somebody else to do what we don't want to do for ourselves. Two friends, good friends, were having a conversation over lunch. The conversation turned to religion. Janine said to her friend Mary, you know, sometimes, she says, I find myself tempted to ask, God, why do you allow so much poverty, hunger, and injustice in the world? Mary says to Janine, well, why don't you ask God that question? Janine says, because I'm afraid God will ask me the same question. Why do you allow so much poverty, hunger, and injustice in the world? God, why do you allow me to stay stuck in this dead-end job? And God says, why do you allow it? God, why do you allow my diabetes to rage out of control? God says, well, why do you? God, why do you allow my relationship to stay so stuck? God says, well, why do you allow it? A pastor was out in his backyard one day when he noticed a stray kitten that had climbed up a tree in his backyard. He tried to coax the kitten down, but the kitten was not responding. The tree was too spindly to climb, so the pastor had an idea. He tied a rope as high as he could reach up around the trunk of the spindly tree, tied the other end of the rope to the hitch of his pickup truck, and then slowly started to pull the pickup truck forward, hoping to bend the tree over enough that he could reach up and rescue the kitten. But as he did so, the rope broke, and the tree flipped back like a slingshot, hurtling that poor kitten out of the tree, over a 6-foot fence, into the wild blue yonder. The pastor looked around the neighborhood afterwards, searching for the kitten everywhere. No signs of the kitten. A week or so later, in the local supermarket, the pastor happens to cross paths with a congregant. He notices that she's got a bag of cat food in her shopping cart. Mary, he says, I see the cat food there. I thought you didn't like cats. Oh, I don't, she says. But pastor, she says, let me tell you a story. My little girl has been pestering the heck out of me to get her a kitten. Finally, the other day I told her, honey, the only way you're ever going to get a cat is if God drops down one to you from heaven. Pastor, she says, I'm not making this up. I watched my little girl go out into the backyard, get down on her knees and pray, and lo and behold, this kitten, paws spread wide, lands out of the clear blue sky right in front of her. And now we have a cat. Wouldn't it be great if life always worked like that? We tell God what it is we need, and then we just sit back and wait until God takes care of everything. God, help me to control my temper better. God, help me to live a long, healthy life. God, help me to get out of debt. God, bring me the man or woman of my dreams. And then we just sit back and we wait, as if it's all up to God. There's a contemporary hymn that we sing here at Life Journey from time to time that really speaks to my soul. The lyrics of that hymn in part go as follows. The earth cries out, nothing feels right. The world cries out, no justice in sight. Fires burning everywhere, too many, too hot, too bright. Second verse, the child cries out, don't turn out the light. Broken hearts cry out, no end of hurt in sight. Greed and guns rule everywhere, too many, too strong to fight. Then comes the chorus. We are waiting for you. We are waiting for you. We are waiting for that Gloria in Excelsis Deo. We're waiting for that moment when the glory of God will break through and fix everything. And at this point, as you're singing the song, you're feeling a certain righteousness that you are among the people on earth who fervently pray to God and long for the day when there will be justice on earth. And you're feeling pretty good about that until you come to the last two lines of the song. We are waiting for you. You are waiting for us too. Oh. Bam. Right between the eyes. So let's recap. In our story so far, we've seen that Jesus asked the man, do you really want to be made well? And the man responds, in essence, yes, but. Yes, but there's no one to help me. I have been waiting here at the pool of Bethesda for months on end for someone like you, Jesus, or somebody else to come along and pick me up and carry me over and drop me in the water. To which Jesus responds in verse 8, oh, you poor thing. Here, let me pick you up and carry you to the water.
What edition?
Right? The New Modern Translation. Of course, that's not what Jesus says. When the man says, yes, I want to be healed, but there's nobody to help me, Jesus responds, stand up, take your mat, and walk. What? Jesus, what kind of an instruction is that? Don't you know how sick I am? Don't you know that for 38 years, I've barely been able to move without the help of others? And you're telling me, stand up and walk? Jesus did not so much as offer him a helping hand up. Jesus never in this story touches the man. In other miracle stories, Jesus will often touch the person, but not here. No helping hand on, up, no touch even. Jesus just fixes his gaze on the man and says, stand up. Get up. Take your mat and walk. And you gotta give the guy credit because by golly, he tries. And verse 9 tells us, at once the man was made well and he took up his mat and he began to walk. Point? The point being, he had to participate in his miracle. He had to be willing to do his part. Jeff, do you think that if Jesus had never come along, that this man, if he had gotten up at any point in time, that he could have walked? In other words, that he had it within him to do it all along? No. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think that's the point of our gospel story. But I also don't believe that the opposite perspective is right. The perspective that says, just tell God about it, sit back and relax, God will take care of it. I think this gospel story is calling us to that difficult balance point somewhere in between those two extremes. That balance point that says, God and I together can do it. Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Notice the verse doesn't say I can do all things, period. It says I can do all things through Christ. Me and God together in dynamic collaboration. Aurora James owns a sustainable fashion brand called Brother Vellies that features fashion designs from Africa and Latin America. Last year, after the George Floyd shooting, she was feeling a great deal of despair in her soul. God, how long will it be before there is finally justice? We are waiting for you. When it occurred to her that there was something she could do, she had an idea. About 15% of the American population is African American. Her idea was what she called the 15% challenge. She put a petition up online calling on major retail stores to take a pledge to reserve 15% of their shelf space for products generated by black-owned and operated businesses. Her petition gathered millions of signatures and created incredible momentum so that she was then able to begin calling out some of these large retailers by name, challenging them to take the 15% pledge. To date, retailers such as J. Crew, Gap, Macy's, Crate and Barrel, Old Navy, Bloomingdale's, Hudson Bay, Banana Republic, etc., have taken the pledge, begun reserving 15% of their shelf space for products generated by black-owned businesses. One woman with an inspired idea creating systemic change. Feel your power. Christ in you. You are not an invalid. You are not a victim. Stand up and walk. Do something, for heaven's sakes. Let me close with this. It's a true story from author and pastor Glenn MacDonald. He tells about a poor family in the Great Depression who had a son born that they named Donnie Dunnigan. At age 3, his parents entered Donnie in a local talent contest. He won. They began to realize their son had a lot of potential. So in a bold act, they pulled up stakes and moved to Hollywood, like the Beverly Hillbillies. They moved to Beverly, right? To give their son a chance to maybe hit it big. 2 years later, when he was 5 years old, he got his first big break. He was cast as the son of Frankenstein in that classic movie. He was the one who got to portray Frankenstein's son at a young age. Pretty cool. Not long after that, Donnie Dunnigan got his second big break, an even bigger break, when he was cast as the voice of Bambi in Disney's classic animated film. Imagine being the voice of Bambi. As time passed, though, his childhood acting career began to fade, as is not unusual, and by the time he was a teen, he was back to normal living. At age 18, he joined the Marine Corps, went on to become the youngest ever Marine Corps drill sergeant. He ended up serving 3 tours of duty in Vietnam, won 3 Purple Hearts, 1 Bronze Star, was promoted up through the rank of major. Ultimately, he retired from the military, went on with his life, and it wasn't until late in his life, looking back, that Donnie Dunnigan began to realize that his role as Bambi in the Disney animated film was a foreshadowing of what he himself would experience in his life. As you know, one of the most traumatic moments in the Bambi film is when Bambi sees his mother gets shot by a hunter, and he watches her die. Then later, as Bambi's grown, He himself takes a bullet from a hunter, and he falls down. Donnie Dunnigan, looking back on that scene, in his own words, describes it this way. He says, quote, "Now Bambi is down. And when big animals are down, they don't get up. Their respiratory system turns bad if they lay there very long, and they end up dying. So Bambi's down, and here comes his father, really close up on camera. He stands over Bambi and says, Bambi, get up. Get up. You must get up. Bambi does, and he survives. What does that have to do with Donnie Dunnigan's life? Picture it. I'm in Vietnam in the mud, Donnie says. It's 2:00 in the morning, close combat, incredibly violent. I'm the commanding officer of a unit that needs me really bad. When I get hit, he takes a bullet. I'm down. I'm half conscious. They need me to be conscious. I had to get on the radio to call for backup support. So I'm down. I'm in the mud. And a young Marine, a great kid, stood over me and shouted, Captain! Captain! Cap! We need you, sir! Get up! Get up! He got up, barely, called for backup, and saved his men. We are waiting for you. You are waiting for us too. Where in your life today are you feeling stuck? And Jesus is saying to you, get up. Stand up and walk. My strength in you is sufficient. You can do this. Do you want to be made well? Do you want to grow and thrive? Do you want to make a difference in a broken world? Well, then don't just sit there and wait. Get up and get after it. You can do this. That's today's amazing encounter with Jesus. The only question now is, how will you respond?